If Murray had supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
Sending out good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes.
108 breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grimerica Show. Coming at you this week with a little Moss Medicine with Robert Dale Rogers coming on the show. We do get into quite a bit of mushroom medicine as well, so it's quite a bit of mushroom talk and moss talk. And if you want to skip ahead to the talk, there's always a timestamp in the show notes to do that. If you want to skip our lazy ramblings, you can do so. We've got everybody's favorite podcaster and his cat here. The cat is very stoic today.
He's staring at the mushrooms on the screen on his website.
Really?
But he's been pawing at the screen. It drives me nuts, man. Oh, a couple of my cats like to paw at the screen.
Yeah, only one of my cats is allowed in the studio.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to keep him out during shows now because they're getting too rambunctious, so... And I don't think it's fair to the guests sometimes if my cat's like staring at the camera.
Especially not if it's the butthole.
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody wants to see that.
But we were just talking about that. My cats won't let me sleep in. It's just unbelievable. Like as soon as the sun comes up, Zeus is like, okay, dad, time to get up. And then you know what? I get up and he's sleeping on my bureau. He just moves from there, to the bureau and he sleeps on there. So he goes to sleep. He wakes me up and then goes to sleep.
Yeah, my cat will meow. It'll just be like, meow. It's 7 in the morning. Time to get up. He gets pretty excited.
I don't know
excited.
Why I didn't notice it before so much, but I don't know.
He gets pretty excited when people get out of bed.
Yeah.
He's pretty excited to start the day.
Yeah, it's the whole thing. They're with you on their routine, you know. Yeah.
Good times. It snowed again here, so now it's nice again. It was snowing this morning, and now it's nice. So I don't know what
snow here right now and tomorrow. And you know what? It just the winter won't end. It's just it's been in that thawing, freezing thing, but it feels like winter still. It's just not ending.
We've been scouting snow geese pretty hard now, man. We've seen a huge flock Sunday night. Sunday night I went out with Shauna, and we've seen who knows. Maybe 100,000 birds, a whole section, like a whole field. Like, you know, the fields are all sectioned off. You can kind of see them. They're like grids, like 1.5 of those just white with birds.
Wow.
And still coming in. So we're working on getting permission because this weekend we got.
Will that happen though? Will that happen again though? Or now that they've been in that field, will the other new ones come in that field? Or is it
stay in the same field for like they're kind of pinned in right now because there's still ice up north, so they're sort of stuck where they're at. It's sort of a line across the province where the ice is let loose, and then everything north of that still has ice, so they're pinned in for I'd say at least
they know this from their scouts or what?
Yeah, well, I don't know how they know, but they won't go north until there's water they can land.
I mean, it might be because it's cold here. It's still too cold here. I mean, I don't know why.
Yeah, they can sense it. Even that lake they're on right now, McGregor, is still like a quarter frozen. So they're like roosted up next to ice. And they'll go back and forth to the same field sometimes for 2 weeks if no one bugs them.
Oh, okay. So you're going to try and get the... Sorry, I kind of interrupted you. You're going to try and
get... scout them again. We'll go scout them again.
And you can try and get access?
Thursday night and then Friday night. Try and get access. Shouldn't be a problem. It's pretty easy around there. No one cares about geese. Yes, the problem right now is it's super wet, so you can't drive in. I'll have to use a quad, drag everything in, and do like 20 trips. Because we got 300 decoys, and then we rented another 400 full body decoys. So we got
what?
It's a full horse trailer full of
what? Oh my god! How long can you leave those out for? Can you leave them out for a while?
Just the weekend. We'll put them out. I mean, the plan right now would be to be on the birds Friday, watch them where they feed, have permission. And then when it gets dark and they head back to the field, we go out there Friday night and set up all the shit. Stay out there till 11:30, get all the fake geese set up, the blinds blinded in, everything ready to go. You head out first thing the next morning, and with a little luck, they come back. They see all the fake geese, so they're not spooked out, and you get to blast a whole bunch of them, hopefully for a couple days in a row. Right. Hopefully they come back again that night. And then because there's so many birds, it's just it's not like they have a news channel, you know, when you got that many birds. I think usually you can hunt a good field like that two or three times before they stop going, especially when there's that many birds on it. Plus
the field is so big. I mean, half the field away is what, like half a mile or?
Yeah. The fields are mile by mile.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and it's like they're flying, then they see that's why you have the decoys. So they see the decoys and think there's already some other birds down there eating, and away they go. And then right now you've also still got the more birds coming in constantly.
Yeah.
See a lot of birds, man, more birds than you ever see. I mean, where you are, you must see tons. We have it good here, but Saskatchewan is the best in the world.
Yeah, it's there's lots, yeah.
Y'all got cranes and shit. You go out now, if you had a license, shoot 50. Imagine how long 50 geese would last you. Well, you and the missus could eat maybe, what, a goose a day? If you had goose every day?
Yeah.
It's like 2 months of meals.
Yeah.
You just need 800 fake geese and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then 50 hours to skin them and... No, it's not 50 hours.
Not 50, man. You fly.
How long does it take to do one if you're just doing it yourself?
In the spring, not long. In the fall, it might take a little longer because a lot more... In the fall, they got fat on them. So a lot of times, you'll keep the skin and the fat, so you pluck them. In the spring, they got no fat left on them because they're coming up from down south. We usually just skin them out. So I can do a bird in like
10 minutes,
45 seconds.
No,
maybe a minute. Yeah. It's just like you get your knife in there, get it started, rip the skin right open. You can just grab it with your hands, get your thumbs up underneath there, and you just peel it all open. So it's just two big breasts sticking out at you and you flay those off. A minute would be high. I would say I could do 50 birds in an hour. I mean, you wouldn't do it in an hour because you're going to get sore and but a couple hours you'd have it done for sure.
Wow.
You'd be sick of it. You'd be sick of it. And then you have 50 carcasses to deal with too. So you got to get them all to the dump or whatever. I mean, I haven't gotten a good limit. The most I've ever had is like 10 or 20 carcasses to deal with at a time. You usually just throw them in the back of the truck and then toss them out the next time you go hunting wherever you're at for the coyotes. But 50 is almost like a biological disaster, you know? It's like, it doesn't seem right to just throw that in a ditch. I guess it's the same as a deer. 50 birds is a lot, especially if you got three dudes with 50 birds. Now you're talking 150. Anyway, hopefully that'll all go well because that's going to be pretty much last crack at spring hunting.
Where are you supposed to put them?
I just bag them up, take them to dump.
The last crack?
For spring.
That's fast, eh?
Probably go through all of April, but we leave on the 20th, and that last weekend before we go is, you know, you can't go shoot 50 birds the day before you go to Easter Island.
Yeah.
Or you got a fucking problem. And then the dump is closed Sunday and Monday, so it's basically, I'll probably get out this weekend. If it goes well, I'll be done. for the spring. It doesn't go well. Then maybe try and get out one more time next week or something before, but we leave Monday morning.
Yeah. Oh,
for Monday. Less than 2 weeks from today to the island. And now Trevor's coming. So there'll be four of us on all those flights together. He's coming down with us, but the flight on the way back was full. So he's on his own on the way back. I think he's a bit nervous about that. We're going to Miami and he's off to Mexico City, which is, I don't know what Mexico City airport looks like, but can't be that bad. It can't be as bad as like the airports we were in, where they don't even fucking really speak English. And you're just like, get off a plane and they cram you into a little room with no seats to just stand there for, was that in Greece?
Turkey, I think. Istanbul, yeah. Wasn't it? Or?
I thought Istanbul is where we had to walk like 5 miles and then wait in line behind that chick with the trashy fucking rainbow hair. Remember, she had like one of those cool, it's like you could tell you were starting to get back into the West. Like, we got to Istanbul and the fucking leftist freaks with the rainbow hair are just starting to come out. And then you get to I think Frankfurt after that. And then you're in the shit by then.
Yep.
And then you go to my Shoppers Drug Mart. I think they got like, there's only 10,000 people in my town and they managed to find like three trannies. I don't even fucking understand how they can fucking do this. It's unbelievable. There's gotta be,
There's something about Shoppers.
There's something about Shoppers.
Yeah.
It's like they're seeking them out.
Yeah.
It's a real conundrum.
Maybe they get the products for free or something. Maybe there's a deal on the products. So it's like, if you're going to be in that milieu, you need products all the time, probably for stuff.
Probably more products.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So
and maybe you get a break on the prescription.
You might as well go.
If you're going to go, go.
I think we're onto something.
Maybe we're in the wrong business. Podcasting is the wrong business. We need to get into
prescriptions.
Ugh, that's where the money is. That's where the money is. We should have got an ivermectin fucking thing going. When everyone was jumping on that train, we could be flogging Grimerica ivermectin right now.
Did you see that thing that couple that got murdered in back east is floating around again? Did you know Barry?
Barry and it was the billionaires, right?
Yeah. Did you know they made ivermectin?
I think I did know that, yeah.
I think I forgot that.
I think it came up during COVID.
Yeah, but I don't know why I didn't really put it two and two together with that. Maybe I think we knew that before ivermectin was canceled.
Yeah, I think I even knew that after. I think it was like a conspiracy that was going around during the COVID times.
Yeah.
When did ivermectin slip into the conversation? I guess when Joe got it.
Well, pretty early, but it got canceled a little later, you know?
Canceled? Well, anyway.
Because my buddy Mike was talking about ivermectin being cancer, like helping with cancer. This is back in 2020 or 2020 or 2021.
After COVID, though.
Yeah, after COVID, but it was early, though.
Well, I suppose the other thing we should mention is the new map is up, if people want to check that out. If they haven't checked out disastermap.ca, get the new disaster map by Grimerica. It's worth checking out. And if you have checked it out and you haven't checked it in a while, it's worth checking out again. It's got all the sort of info tabs on everything. So you can get info on a bunch of stuff. We added volcanoes. You can do more than one comet in a run now. You can do up to 3 comets at a time, 5 nukes at a time. There's an ice age mode. What else we got? We got volcanoes now. So instead of just super volcanoes, there's a toggle on here that'll show you every volcano on Earth. There is, how many volcanoes do you think there is, Graham?
Oh, I don't know. There's a couple thousand probably.
1,215, I think.
That's pretty close.
Yeah, and the other cool thing is that if they're blinking on the map, once you toggle them on, they'll all come on as little dots. They're different colors for dormant or different types. And if they're blinking, they're sort of just erupting right now. Like there's super volcanoes that are erupting right now, it says. Wow. It says Krishamayama. Super volcano. It's a large group of more than 20 quaternary volcanoes located north of Kagoshima Bay.
Wow.
I mean, Japan, the thing you get this map and you look at Japan and you're like, no, thanks.
So you can erupt, but you can erupt them too, right? Like you can go to a volcano, click on it, and then click erupt and it'll show you their estimation of the eruption, right?
Correct. You can erupt any of the volcanoes on the planet and get the same sort of rings as you get from the other ones. We got storm surges now, so you can simulate earthquake storm surges and earthquakes.
Can you make a little icon for the flood and the impact, or?
What do you mean? Oh, like an info icon?
Yeah, when you go to the main page and you have all the different like storm surge, mega tsunami, they all have icons except for the top two there.
Yeah, they should probably all have them eventually, a little icon there so you can see. Yeah. And then we got all the toggles on there, which people might get excited about, is like the Megalis one where you can toggle that on and it'll bring up 129,000 sites on the planet.
Yeah, so if you're ever looking for Megalis on a map.
Yes, you can see the ones that are close to your house. And then you can see the ones that are close to your house.
Yeah.
And then not only that, you could click on them and see if you get a little picture and a little write up and decide if you think that they're worth going to check out or not.
Right. And then also, along with those toggles, you've got UNESCO sites, airports, nuclear plants, live fires. Wow. That's awesome, dude.
And pole flips. So check it out. And if you like it, get the pro mode. Support us is another way to support us. And it's fun. I mean, if you got the pro mode with all the toggles on, you don't even have to be doing disasters. You can have sort of fun just going around looking at the megalithic sites and all that sort of stuff. You don't even
Or if you click on the volcano one, I mean, it's just crazy how you see these rings, like these lines of volcanoes along the fault lines. Like it's really interesting to see how the
volcano around the Pacific Ocean, especially, you can just see the ring of volcanoes, or the ring of fire. I guess that's why they, that's why they call it that. It's definitely, definitely pretty cool. It's come farther than I would have thought it could come on. So now you can see all your volcanoes, see all your megalithic sites, and
I just came across the live one. There's multiple live ones. They're flashing, right?
Yeah, the live volcanoes are throbbing.
Yeah, I just came across two of them in the Pacific Rim erupting now. Stratovolcano. It says it's part of the United States. That's weird. Stratovolcano. Oh, Farallonda Parios. And then there's two more Japan. There's one going off in Japan right now. Volcanic field erupting now. It's called Abu. That one's going off too. I just came across. Oh, there's another one. Hang on. Let me just check this. Asosan is also going off.
It's crazy how many megalithic sites are in the UK. It really is. It's like you can't even really see the island. It's just.
That's why it's such a magical place, man. I mean, it's. So let me see. Toggle. Oh my God. It's full of them.
It's full of them, that whole island.
When you zoom out, the whole island is full of them. And of course, Europe too.
UK Posse could have a blast on there. Go check them all out. There's pictures of them. Shout out to Megalithic UK. That's where I got the CSV for that to plug that in. So luckily they had it made already, so I could just use the data. But people can check it out. That's our vibe code and project, disastermap.ca. It's a way to support the show and do some cool stuff at the same time. And if you do, speaking of support the show, we do have some people to thank. We need people supporting the show. It's value for value. So we just keep doing all these podcasts, interviewing people. We got some great shows. We had Randall last week. We got Scott Walter coming out right away. Some great shows coming up. We're getting some value from the podcast. do head over to grimeamerica.ca/support today and sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. That's the way of ensuring that the show is still here when you want it to be down the road. By just, you know, if we get everyone up for a buck or two a month, we wouldn't have to ask you anymore, but we're just having a hard time. Thank you to the 1% or 2% that do come out and support, and we will read your note and you will become a noble in the great hegemony of Grimerica instead of a pleb, a shitty pleb. And we do have some people to thank this week. We have Morgan Maynard, who came in at $3.69 a month. So thank you, Morgan. And Melissa Adams, who came in with a $100 one-time donation.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, you folks, for supporting the good work. If you want to be like them, we ask that you do be like them. Head over to grimeamerica.ca/support today. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. We had some good audiobooks come out this week, too, and we'll get them into the audiobook feed probably in the next day or two. But right now, they came out on Audible way faster than expected. Usually it's like I have a week or two to get everything else caught up, but they went on Audible in like 24 hours. So we got Technocracy Inc. and a bunch of other short ones, right? The Green Book of Secret Rights, The Willows, The Great Stone Face, The Damned Thing, The Man Who Could Work Miracles, The Scarlet Plague is new. Propaganda, that's just on the first page. And then, of course, this is another Barclay Cavill job, right?
Well, the Technocracy one is Barclay Cavill, yeah.
Was it Cavill? I thought it was Cavill. The interesting thing about Barclay is he sounds surprisingly like someone we know.
A sign that humanity has matured beyond politics and ideology. But stripped to its core, technocracy means rule by engineers, systems, and experts where authority.
Barclay's hell of a
narrative. Either. That's me.
Oh, whoa.
That was a slog.
You're not supposed to say that.
No, in a good way. It's just long. It's long and in depth.
How long do you think it is?
No, I don't know. What is it? 15 hours, maybe? 11 hours? 12?
It's, where does it say?
At the back, if you go to the front.
13 hours.
13, yeah. So those little ones are part of like a compilation that we're doing called 11 Tales of the Unknown Before Lovecraft. So it's kind of like early sci-fi, weird tales, and speculative fiction. Kind of like that cosmic horror stuff. So there's some really good gems in there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're going to Easter Island in like 13 days. Are you excited? Are you nervous? Are you, where are you at?
Both.
What are you nervous about?
Well, just leaving Maria. She's, you know, sick right now, so that's hard.
Yeah, it's a lot of flying, too.
A lot of flying. The war, you know. Global events. being stuck on an island, like, in the most remote part of the world.
Seems like every time we go someplace, there's a fucking conflict. Yeah. Was there a conflict when we went to Egypt? I don't think so, right?
Oh, I think afterwards.
But there's been a couple times where we're going someplace, and I'm like, oof, is this the best time? I mean, it's been like that from day one, right? During COVID. Technically not even allowed, and we still did it. Now it's like, yeah, what are you going to do? Because when we went to Cosmic Summit, I think there was a war with Iran then, too. And then I remember going to Texas the weekend that COVID started, and I was sick. And I was on the plane. I was like, I was in Texas with the Snake Bros when all this like pandemic stuff starts coming out and they start canceling flights. And I'm in Texas just going like, oh God, I'm going to get stuck. And I'm sick. So that I get to fly back still sick, possibly with COVID in a couple days.
Yeah.
It's been a wild fucking few years. I think all that, I mean, it's at least we're staying in this hemisphere. The bros are in Egypt or just got back from Egypt. What's his name? Frank, friend of the show, Frank. He's just on his way to Cairo right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then we got a bunch of people going this fall with Ben. I think the Kerbers are going, maybe Kyle. Ed and Renee, Chuck, a bunch of them.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I thought about going back, but it's just I'm not ready yet. It'll be a few more years before I'm ready to go through all that again.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, a lot of traveling, a lot of, I mean, it's just, I'm looking forward to Easter Island because I feel like it'll be chill in a way that Egypt was not. It was very like high pressure, not socially, but just everywhere you go, everyone wants something from you. Hoping that won't be the case on the island or even in Santiago, maybe.
Yeah.
Santiago, we won't see much of. But anyway, if people want to get in on that, there's like a spot left. If you want to make a last minute decision, you better do it quick. I'm going to shut down sales in the next few days as it just becomes too much of a logistical headache to try and squeeze someone in. So you got a couple days, contact at thecabin.com. New York Finger Lakes tour is also filling up quick. So if people want to check that out with Randall, that one. All there, contact at thecabin.com. And then there's, of course, the Solstice one at Serpent Mound where we're going to have a blast this summer, first day of summer. Solstice rising over the serpent's head or however it does it, or check that out. I'll be presenting there. And that's your classic CAC event that's very cheap to get in. It's camping. There's all that sort of stuff. It'll be very Duck Creek. There's a bunch of people coming that are, we like the Duck Creek crew getting back together. So all that's there. Contact at thecabin.com. Disastermap.ca. What else? Is that it?
I think that's about it, yeah.
That's it for this week. That's enough for this week's intro. Anyway, we lead up to the big trip. I mean, we'll have a good report from Easter Island, at least. We'll try and get some. We got some little cameras. We'll try and get some good footage maybe for the YouTube channel. See what we can do and get you guys a nice report from Easter Island. A picture of Graham and I by a Moai. That'll be kind of surreal, right?
Oh, yeah. If we can find the exact one that that our logo's made from.
Hang out with them for a little while.
Yeah.
Do you have a bio?
I do, yeah. Robert's been a student of plant medicine most of his life, a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild and author over 50 books on medicinal plants of Western Canada. So he's a local guy in Alberta. So he knows Alberta's like by, what would I call it? His botany, Alberta's botany, like the back of his hand. Got a bachelor's degree in botany. He's taught plant medicine for over 40 years, an avid fan of indigenous plants and mushrooms. Long career in alternative health field, clinical herbalist for over 18 years, and a consultant at various boards and industries advising growers and creating herbal formulas. So selfhealdistributing.com is his website. I've got a link to that in the show notes, along with innertraditions.com/Robert Dale Rogers, author Robert Dale Rogers in there as well, which has a few of his books in there, including the one we talk about mostly, Moss Medicine.
I would say it's 50-50 with mushroom medicine.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great chat. He seems like a great guy, and he's only like an hour and a half up the road from me, so
yeah.
We'll cross paths one day when he's out there, when we're both out there harvesting. Anyway, guys, we love you. Support the show and enjoy the chat with Robert Rogers.
Welcome, Robert Rogers, to Grimerica. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Nice to be here.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your new book, Moss Medicine, Indigenous Wisdom and Modern Pharmacology. Also, probably some other stuff in general. I mean, being in Canada and Alberta, super interesting to know that people like yourself are out there figuring out what is good out in the wild, you know, wild crafting. So thank you for your work.
Yeah, no problem. Basically, I started out, I mean, my background is a herbalist, so I learned sort of all the plants that are in Alberta, northern Alberta for sure. And then I went on to discover mushrooms and did work on medicinal mushrooms. And then that led me more recently to lichens and ferns and mosses and things of that nature. So the Moss Medicine is the third book on this series. All right. Fern Pharmacy before that and medicinal lichens. Yeah,
nice. Well, I hope somebody is preserving all this ancient wisdom, and because everything becomes so pharmacized, you know, where we're all, you know, we're taking pills. We get to this point where in modern medicine and we don't realize how much there was before that can help us. So it's awesome to know that people like you are out there like cataloging it all and researching it all and preserving all this ancient wisdom for everybody.
Well, yeah. I mean, indigenous wisdom, I mean, it needs to be preserved. In fact, I graduated with a Bachelor of Science in 1971 from the University of Alberta and went to live up north on Lesser Slave Lake and didn't know one plant in the forest, not one.
Wow.
After a bachelor degree, you know, in botany.
Yeah.
And so I was fortunate enough to have a couple of Cree medicine people who lived in the neighborhood and started learning from them. And about 35 years later, Dr. David Young and I, along with Russell Willier, we put out a book called A Cree Healer and His Medicine Bundle, in which he shared his oral, 10th generation oral memory of a medicine bundle with herbs that were for particular health conditions. And thank goodness he felt comfortable enough with the two of us to preserve that knowledge or it would be lost forever.
He died
a few years ago. So that was fortunate. Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's a great example. 10th generation, and somebody's finally writing it down. Not that there's anything wrong with the oral traditions and all, but I mean, this is, you know, what happens is we end up losing it.
Well, yeah, he's gone, and none of his sons wanted to carry on the work.
Right.
So basically that would have been the end of it, which would have been most unfortunate. Yeah. Yeah.
So all this is going on in Alberta and BC. So when you did your Moss Medicine book, because you've written 60 books, you've been looking at this for 50 years, look at all this stuff for 50 years. What was it like doing your Moss one and working with the indigenous for the Moss book?
Well, that was pretty interesting. I mean, I knew little bits, particularly out of the Cree tradition. You know, there's about 14,000 moss species around the world. And what's interesting, I think, is when most people go on a walk, the first thing that they probably start looking and cluing into are trees. You know, their trees are pretty distinct and different. And then if a plant is in flower, of course, they start to learn a little bit about what the flower looks like, what a rose looks like, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, the rest for most people is just this green curtain where you have no idea what it is until you get really down on your knees with a little hand lens. A lot of these plants, particularly the mosses, are indistinguishable. And so one of the challenges of this was to put a book together that not only had some great information to pass on from the oral tradition of indigenous, but also pictures so that people could actually go out and try to identify them for themselves. And then some of the different things that were useful for. Yeah.
And how do you pronounce that word? What are they called? Bryophytes?
Yeah. So bryophytes are the broad term of mosses, liverworts and hornworts. There, okay. there are three different categories. And the liverworts are also interesting. I do share an entire chapter with them. But basically, they are very unusual, have compounds and chemicals in them that are anti-cancer, are used for blood sugar, things of that nature. And they all of them contain very distinct essential oils. So when you come upon a liverwort and you squeeze it and you smell it, you get a very distinct smell, very distinct. Yeah.
That's why they call them liverworts, probably.
Well, liverwort, thank you. Well, actually, it goes back. Actually, liverwort is an old English word. A wort was a word for plants, right? Worts, like, you know, St. John's wort.
Like hogworts,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And the use of liver was because the shape of one of the liverworts looked like a human liver. And so it was therefore in the Doctrine of Signatures, because of its shape, it was used for liver function. And it so happens that it actually did work quite well.
Yeah, that sympathetic sort of, what they call that a sympathy, right? Back in the old sort of magical terms. And is that really a thing, do you think, that that some of these shape, like from what you've learned?
Partially. I think it was a way to, for people before, when it was just an oral tradition, for people to pass on some knowledge. For example, you know, dandelion has a yellow flower. And so yellow meaning it's related to the liver, right? Because you get jaundice if your liver is, so you look yellow, right?
Yeah.
And things like that are red for the heart or blue for the nerves or something. And so not just flowers, but the shape of the leaf, things of that nature. And more often than not, it shows to be true. But you can carry it to a ridiculous length, and sometimes it is beneficial, and sometimes it's better to check it out with the herbalist.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So this book has you made it an illustrated encyclopedia, right? So there's full of like hundreds of pictures.
I would say there's hundreds, over 100 for sure.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and I was very fortunate that I have friends who love photography, and three of them were more than willing to share their photographs with me, and so, you know, that was nice. That, you know, they live mostly in Washington State, and well, other areas as well. One of them travels all over the world taking pictures of everything. And so I'm really indebted to them for helping to fill out and give pictures that help people identify the particular mosses. I also would think that if people who are interested in this subject, there are even better identification books on moss. But so this is a book about, you know, how were they used traditionally? How are they useful in modern times, like how are we using them for natural medicine today? And so that's what the whole thing's about, really.
Yeah. Well, was there anything that stood out to you that Western botany largely overlooked at all, or any eureka moments that plants that sort of hooked you through the process?
Oh yeah. Well, as you start doing the deep dive into research, you start to recognize that a lot of the traditional uses actually are backed up by modern pharmacology, that the chemistry of those particular mosses or liverworts, they actually were compounds in there that did actually have active, physiological activity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And what, is there anything that Western botany overlooked?
Pardon me.
Darren, we're echoing since you came in.
Okay.
Welcome. Darren, this is Robert. Robert, Darren.
You're getting a real feedback here.
Yeah.
And now it says I can't change it while recording.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, now it's gone, I think. Oh, no.
Is it gone? Is it back?
Maybe I can do something. Here, let me try echo cancellation on you. Oh, can't be changed while recording. Weird. That's not good.
That's not good.
So maybe can you mute yourself?
Yeah, I'll just mute. Let me see what that does.
Check, check, testing. Okay, that's set. Okay, that's fixed it. Let's fix it for now. So yeah, I was, so Robert, Darren's here late. Sorry. Nice. You guys can, meet each other.
Hey, Darren. Yeah.
And, what I was trying to ask you is, did Western botany, like, did you find anything that Western botany kind of largely overlooked?
Yeah, absolutely. Mosses, because they're under feet and they don't really have distinguishing kind of characteristics. Very often people are walking on them all over the forest and they don't even recognize, you know, the subtleties of how they're all different, how they're all different, have been traditionally used for different purposes. I mean, in many parts of the world, particularly like the Cree in northern Alberta, for example, and Saskatchewan, they would actually build moss houses. And these were little lean-tos in the spruce forests. Where they would gather moss, particularly where they would gather moss, particularly. Yeah,
they did would, the echo come gather. Back?
No, it didn't. Oh, yeah, it did. Yeah. I'm echoing, but you're not.
All right, I'll just stay muted.
Okay. So the you're mentioning that they're gathering peat mosses?
Yeah. You know, the other thing we could do is we could start from scratch right again. If
No, it's all good. It's okay.
It's all good? Okay. So they would build these houses and then they would dry the peat moss and they use particular ones. Some are more irritating than others. And they would use particular species that they would dry underneath, and they would be there all winter. Of course, when the snow fell, they would be still dry and protected, and they would be used for sanitary purposes, like for women, for menses, for babies, for diaper things of that nature. And so that was one of the main things they used on a daily basis.
That's fascinating. So did your work take you to the coast at all, like the more of the boreal sort of rainforest coast area?
I do go out there occasionally. I do like Vancouver Island. I was half thinking of retiring there, but I know Alberta a lot better, so it was just as nice to stay here. And if you go out to a wetter climate, of course, you're going to have more moss. That's just the way it is. They'll be in people's backyards, right? The mosses. And that's the one thing that's very unique that most people don't know about moss is that they have no root. They have no root, so they have no way to draw up water. They have to get their water from the air. And so that really restricts where they'll grow. And when they don't get enough moisture, they will dry up and they look like they're dead and then they'll desiccate themselves. And then when they get some moisture, they'll green up and come back to life and carry on. And so they're pretty, pretty hardy that way.
Yeah.
Is there any difference between the dry mosses and the wet mosses and medicinal properties?
Yeah, I think if people are collecting mosses for medicine, that's a great question. That your best bet is to dry them first. You know, use low temperature in the shade, dry the mosses, and then you can use them as infusions, that is like a herbal tea, or that you can then tincture them in water and alcohol for preserving them for long-term use. So I think it's always best to dry them first, yeah.
What about the prairies? Anything on the prairies?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm right here in Camrose, Alberta, and it's pretty prairie. And if you go into the coulees down in where the valleys are, and particularly on the north-facing slopes, you'll often get, different different trees and including sometimes conifers. And down below there, you'll find mosses pretty well everywhere. So yeah, they, as long as there's a source of moisture of some type, and it can be atmospheric, or let's say it rains and then it slowly trickles down from the trees, and the moss are more than happy to take up that moisture.
Yeah, that's kind of why I was asking, because I feel in Saskatchewan, it's so dry here. And when I was in Alberta too, very dry compared to BC.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. Well, British Columbia is like, if you're interested in lichens and you're interested in mushrooms, then probably British Columbia is the place to be if you really want to collect those and study those things. But that's what I said. I wrote a book called The Fungal Pharmacy, Medicinal Mushrooms, about 2011. And everybody I meet, when I meet people, they go, well, we just assumed you lived in British Columbia. We had no idea you lived in Alberta.
Yeah. I mean, that's really come a long ways, mushrooms. I mean, man, you were probably a big part of that. 2011, it seems like the last 10, 15 years, mushrooms are everywhere, the medicinal mushrooms and people's coffees. They have these blends now, and it's really getting popular.
Yeah, I just worked with the company, put some medicinal mushrooms in their chocolates. Medicinal mushrooms the last 15 years, 20 years. I started my work about back in the early 2004, I put out a little book. And then 2011, a bigger book, which has really got me around the world, actually, which is very fortunate. But the idea of people eating mushrooms, taking supplements on a daily basis, that market's growing 9% a year.
Wow.
And has for the last decade.
So, wow.
You know, it's like in North America, I think it's like a $35 billion industry and projected to be double that in the next 5 years. So, yeah. So people are tuning into mushrooms for sure.
Is that strictly like medicinal mushrooms of like the non-psychedelic variety, or are you starting to see the psychedelic sort of treatments and stuff come up with that as well?
Well, yeah, I have helped some companies that wanted to get into that particular sphere, but until there's basically a different governmental regulation, that probably is stalled out. I mean, the reality is, for psilocybin mushrooms, you can grow enough for Canada in a very small warehouse. You don't need big facilities for that, and it will come. It's just a matter. In fact, there's a company out of British Columbia that were very prime in putting together the legislative legalese that forced the federal government to legalize cannabis. And they've taken that exact document, and all they did is they took out cannabis and put in psilocybin. It is the word change, and that's moving its way through the court system as we speak. So it will happen for sure.
That's good to hear, because it seemed like it was gaining traction and then it seemed like it got snagged up again. I mean, there was a time when we were predicting it might have even happened at the same time or before cannabis. I mean, you had some of those states especially really starting to venture into that kind of stuff, and it's sort of come out of the taboo and people going, you know, it's just like there's websites, click on it to go to South America to do ayahuasca and all these sorts of things. And it's like, well, how long can the West just ignore this stuff?
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think the difference is that a lot of the people who got initially into cannabis and then they, you know, had a huge amount of shares and then they sold out, the CEOs especially, as the cannabis industry got too big. They moved a lot of their money into growing mushrooms and without realizing that it's going to take longer. And so there are people sitting out there with warehouses that are totally empty, unfortunately. Yeah, but it'll come. It'll come.
Which is the medicinal or mushrooms, do they have a lot more medicinal? Because you hear a lot about mushrooms, right? They're magic, they're aliens, there's all these sort of weird metaphysical sort of levels to mushrooms. Is moss sort of the same way, or which one is more medicinal? Because moss is sort of overlooked, right? You don't hear a lot of people talking about it, a little bit, but definitely not as prevalent as mushrooms are in the zeitgeist.
No. The moss book is really a primer, I think, for introducing people to the medicinal aspects of it, of the bryophytes as a whole. I think it's been largely ignored even by herbalists. And so this book is really hoping to introduce people to do further research, to look into them further. I do talk about some of the major ones that are used today, but it still is a matter of people getting used to the idea. I mean, mushrooms are easy and in a lot of ways. They are easy to grow, and some of them are incredibly beneficial. They started out, a lot of the industry started out in Asia, China, Japan, et cetera. But now in North America, there's a lot of companies producing high quality, factory, organic, medicinal mushrooms for the market. And that's going to keep getting bigger. Absolutely. Yeah.
Where do store mushrooms sort of fit in on that scale? Like the stuff you get at the store, even if you get the organic ones, are those any good, just the supermarket mushrooms?
Absolutely. You bring up a good point. Never, ever buy mushrooms in the store that are not organic. That is, there's still some companies that believe they cannot produce button mushrooms, you know, the white and brown ones that you see in the grocery store, that they believe that, you know, you can't grow those organically. Well, do I want fungicides in my mushrooms? I don't think so. So for example, button mushrooms, which are the crimini, the portobello, you know, the great big ones that they charge extra for that are mature, all of those are the same mushroom. And they are very beneficial for cholesterol, reducing cholesterol, reducing blood sugar. And we're talking about human clinical trials. So, button mushrooms also contain something called an aromatase inhibitor, which actually restricts the growth of breast cancer cells. They did a study 30 years ago, maybe, in California, where women with breast cancer were introduced to button mushrooms, a certain one group. And then they were introduced, and a certain percentage of benefit. And then they were introduced to green tea, a certain benefit as well. And then they combined them. They combined a diet with button mushrooms and green tea, and it had the highest efficacy. Almost 92% of people who took this were, cured of their breast cancers.
Does that include all the button mushrooms you mentioned? Because you said the portobello, does it have to be the little ones, or can it be the portobello? No,
it can be all of them. They all contain the same compounds, right? They're all very useful. And they also, you know, you can also increase your vitamin D content. You can take those mushrooms from the store and you take them home, turn them upside down, you know, gill side up, and expose them to sunlight. And you can triple or quadruple your vitamin D content. And it's very interesting to note, particularly people in northern climates are very deficient of vitamin D, which is a very important, I would say it's more than a vitamin. It's actually a pro-hormone. And so, yeah, you can increase your efficacy. And now in the stores, you go in, it used to be buttons only. Now you can find lion's mane in regular stores, which is for neurological health. You can find shiitake, which are my favorite. If you're going to go vegan or vegetarian, shiitake mushroom is an excellent source of protein and fats and vitamins, as well as antiviral, you know, really good for preventing influenza, herpes virus, you know, all kinds of viruses are susceptible to shiitake influence. So, and enoki, you know, the little white ones that are grown in high carbon dioxide and low light, those also, they did an epidemiological study in Japan on enoki quite a few years ago. They actually went around and found out what part of Japan has the lowest incidence of cancer? And they narrowed it down to this one little town, Nagano. They go, well, is it the water? Is it the air? Like, what is it that makes the low levels of all cancers so low? And what they found is that people, this is where they were growing enoki mushrooms, and people were taking the extras home. And so they were eating more, the highest consumption of enokis in Japan, hence low levels of cancer. So there you go.
I wonder how they found that out. They had to check all these different things. What are they doing different in Nagano? And then they figured out, oh, they're all bringing home these mushrooms. That must have been fascinating.
Yeah. And then they did, of course, the studies. They did the in vitro, the in vivo with animals. And then they did start doing studies with humans. Of course, that's how it goes.
Again, it starts in Japan. It seems like a lot of this health stuff, they start getting serious about it in Japan, and then it spills over to the West.
Yeah. I think we're fortunate to be able to piggyback on their research. When I was studying, working on medicinal mushrooms, Korea, China, and Japan are the big three that actually have spent a lot of money, a lot of time. In fact, Japan, they spent, well, this is years ago, probably 20 years ago, they were spending at that time $3.2 billion in their healthcare system, which is universal like Canada, like quote free. I mean, it's not free. You pay by taxes. But but they were giving turkey tail mushrooms to people who had previously had colorectal cancer. And they gave them 1 gram twice a day of turkey tail after the surgery. And those individuals... And they gave another group of a couple of hundred people placebo. The placebo people lived about 4.6 years after the surgery, this colorectal where they cut out the cancer, resected up the bowel. And the group that were given really tiny, 1 gram twice a day of turkey tail, 10.6 years, fully 6 years more.
Wow.
So they followed them, everybody, till the end of their life. Well, I think that's a very valid study. I think that's a very, that's the kind of thing that people should be aware of in oncology centers. When people go to be treated for cancer, they should be well informed about some of their options that are out there.
And what about, I wonder how those mushrooms would have worked if they would have done it without going in and trying and cutting out first and doing chemo and whatever else they did along the way. I wonder if the mushrooms are more effective outside of a chemo environment or inside it.
That's a great question. At the beginning of COVID, I had some time to do research. So I put together a book called Medicinal Mushrooms, the Human Clinical Trials. And I looked, scoured through, because I would often have oncologists or other practitioners, biomedical practitioners, come to me after giving a talk and go, well, Robert, you know, there's no proof they really work with humans, right? And so I wrote this book, basically, and there's several hundred studies of varying types. Some are only a dozen people. Some are thousands of people, where they're actually showing that as an adjunct, they work really well with chemotherapy or radiation for not only preventing the side effects associated with those therapies, but extending lifespan as well. And those are proven in clinical trials. One of the things you have to remember about mushrooms and why you should eat them, not every day, but often, is they also act preventatively. They actually enhance the ability of your body to produce the right amount of natural killer cells and lymphocytes and things that actually gobble up aberrant cancer cells as we go. I mean, we all have cancer cells in our body, and our effective immune system has this guard, it has these different gateways. And what mushrooms do is they protect people's immune system to not allow these aberrant cells to continue to grow. The body will kill them. It's called apoptosis, self-programmed death, and then recycle the tissue, the constituents, And that, therefore, they're really good as a preventative as well, not just for treatment, but for prevention. Yeah.
I was going to ask that. So is that just like, is that a supplement, or is just eating mushrooms every day good enough? And should you be eating a different kind every day?
That's a great question. If you can get access to them, eating them on a regular basis is great. I mean, they're so easy to add into everything. Like, you know, we're gonna have some bison burgers for supper. And I love some shiitake mushrooms, a mushroom burger with that organic bison burger. Yeah, why not? You know, or if you're going to have a soup or a stew or whatever. Different mushrooms are actually, and some are edible, some are not. I mean, the most famous mushroom, medicinal mushroom, is reishi, the Ganoderma out of China and Japan. And it's hard like a rock. And so it's not really edible. So you need to get it as a prepared formulation, either liquid or in a capsule or something like that. But lots of mushrooms are edible. Absolutely.
Have you seen that meme? That meme of the guy talking to the mushroom, and he says, live humans eat dead mushrooms, and the mushroom's looking back at him saying, live mushrooms eat dead humans.
Isn't that true? they actually has there's a company, I think it's out of the States now, where you can get actually buried in a mushroom casket. You know, like it's made out of mycelium, and then you
awesome.
Go into the ground. And of course, that breaks down rather quickly. And
So your body gets like just injected into the whole mycelium network all over the planet of the mushrooms.
That's it. Well, that's it. I mean, basically, when people think mushroom, they think the fruiting body, which is the sexual organ, that the mycelium is under the ground all the time. It's just, it will pop on different ears depending on when the conditions are right for sporulation, for helping extend their life. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I wanted to ask you, I guess this could apply to the moss and the mushrooms and all that, but your ethical wildcrafting suggestions, like if people are harvesting mushrooms or moss on the coast or even in the wherever, is there anything they should keep in mind to be able to keep the natural habitat in a proper condition?
That's a great question. Well, when it comes to moss, Alberta is a huge producer of peat moss. Like there's just hundreds and hundreds of square miles of peat land in Alberta, and they're harvesting on a regular basis, drying it, and then that's shipped all over, mainly to the States for helping people add to their gardens. You know, peat moss has this ability to retain water, some 20 times its weight or whatever. And so an item like peat moss, which has a number of different medicinal uses, particularly antiseptic, and was used basically in World War I, is where it was started to be written about, when battle wounds, sphagnum moss was found more effective than just bandages.
Wow.
Because it's antibacterial as well, and it prevented infection. So I would say that's true, that the mosses are, there's certain mosses that you're not going to ever run out of. Same with lichens. In northern Saskatchewan, there are tree lichens, like huge amounts of Usnea lichen per hectare up in northern Saskatchewan. You would never cause a problem.
Yeah.
However, having said that, certain parts of North America, some of these things are quite scarce and people need to pay attention. And the same with mushrooms, right? In Saskatchewan, as you know, there's a chanterelle and pine mushroom harvest every early summer up by L'Orange in those areas. And those fruiting bodies, they come back year after year if you're careful about how you pick them and you don't crush all of the environment that they're in. So I wouldn't worry too much about that.
Right. Before we dig into the book a little bit more, while I got you here, I'm going to be a little bit selfish, even though this won't apply to a lot of our audience, but you're only an hour and a half or 2 hours away from where I am. I'm spending probably a lot of time hunting. I'm out hunting most of the fall. out hunting in the spring. So I find myself in the native prairie and in the coulees a lot. So while I've got an Alberta plant guy on the line, I would be remiss, and you've got all these things hanging behind you, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask just what opportunities I'm missing right here around my house out when I'm out in these plains. Obviously, the sage is the one everyone knows about. It's everywhere. You can try it out. But what else should I be picking while I'm out there? Because my wife and my kids come along quite a bit, and it's like if we could turn it into a harvest and a hunt, it you know, we could be leaving something on the table right now is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, well, I just moved a year ago from Edmonton down to Camrose, and I have an adjunct at the university here now, professor, and I do summer walks. I take people usually on three-hour walks where we usually see 40 or 50 plants, identify them, talk a little bit about their traditional uses, how you can integrate them into your life on a regular basis. And for example, the artemisias, we have eight or nine different what are called sage, but they're artemisia actually, in Alberta, and they're very valuable. In fact, I do once in a while a program by Kevin. Do you know Kevin Kozowan? Are you familiar with his work? He's got a series, season 12 now, called From the Wild. And he goes out with people into the wild, just like I would go out with him. And we find plants and we talk about them and we prepare food from them. And we just did that down by the other day. Last summer, we did that down by further southern Alberta, a couple of hours south of where I live. And yeah, you can. I mean, there's a plethora. I mean, we just went into the woods, didn't have any idea what we were going to do. And we found fairy ring mushrooms, puffballs, cacti. I'm doing a book on medicinal cacti down the road here. It's going to come out next fall. And there's three different species of cacti, and they're all edible. And so there's a wealth out there for the wildcrafter if you want to learn that kind of thing. Yeah. And I give walks once in a while. I'd probably do at least one walk in Camrose this summer, I would think.
You know, that makes me think, because you mentioned the cactuses. So you've got the mushrooms with all these medicinal properties, and then they got these psychedelic features as well that seem to help with maybe some spiritual healing. Maybe it depends where you sit on that spectrum. But then you mentioned the cactuses, and they've got this healing side and this psychedelic side that the yeah. American Indians were using all the time. So what about moss? Is there a psychedelic moss?
There is not. Not that I found. There are some lichens that are, but the mosses, I haven't found any. But I have found some very interesting uses for some of them that are beginning to be explored a bit by biomedicine. There's one called the giant rose moss. And basically, they have found that with human clinical trials, that taking it internally as a medicine increases the blood flow of the aorta of the heart by 30%. That's quite remarkable. And this other moss that I investigated quite a bit is bioreactor in Germany. They're growing it in a controlled setting. And what they found is constituent of it is very useful for a genetic predisposition called Fabry disease. There's an enzyme deficiency at birth that doesn't allow people to break down fats properly. And this particular compound actually helps correct that deficiency. Think about that. It's wow. Correcting a DNA misprint. And so, yeah, there's lots. I mean, I go on for hundreds of pages. There's lots of uses of mosses, yeah.
Are they related at all? Is there any relation between the mushrooms and the mosses? I mean, they both seem to have some of the same sort of properties where they can grow sort of quickly. And you mentioned that the moss doesn't have the root. And sometimes the mushrooms, some types of mushrooms, especially the ones on the sides of the trees and stuff, they don't really seem to have roots either.
Well, the ones that are, well, they're not related. I'll straighten that out. But mushrooms that grow on trees, usually what we call polypores, because they have pores rather than gills, and they're usually quite firm, right? The ones on the trees, their mycelium is all through the tree itself, right down to the roots. So you don't see the mycelium, but it's there for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And those are some of my favorites. In fact, several that I really love. I mean, red-belted conch, the Fomatopsis is a really common one in the forest. You'll find it on pine and spruce trees just about everywhere. And it's a really warming, immune-enhancing mushroom. And you can make it either slicing it thin and decocting, making it into a tea, or you can boil it and then do an alcohol, do an extraction with both water and alcohol. And you have a tincture that you can take on a regular basis for inflammation. That's the one thing about medicinal mushrooms, all of them. Not only do they enhance the immune system, modulate it, and that's a key word, but they also reduce inflammation. 100% of them do. And what it means by modulation is, let's say your immune system's not functioning optimally, it will bring it up to, it'll bring it up to optimal levels, where, let us say you have an autoimmune condition. Let's say you have, you know, rheumatoid arthritis in the fingers, let's say, for example. That's an overreaction where the immune system is attacking your own body. It will reduce that inflammation.
Wow.
So it'll go both directions. It's an immune modulator, these mushrooms. So they help to optimize your overall health. That's probably why they're becoming more and more popular.
You mentioned the mycelium, which is always, it reminds me of Paul Stamets talking about how you've got these huge mycelium networks in the Pacific Northwest that are all sort of interconnected, and it's the largest sort of super organism on earth, this mycelium network, where all these mushrooms are, they're fungus, I guess, are connected. Are the mosses connected like that at all? Is there any sort of connection between, say, a peat moss? Is that just little individual plants, or is that like a super organism as well?
That's a great question. So the mosses themselves, they grow where they like it, where they want to. They don't have any roots. So one of the things you can do if you want to have moss in your yard is you basically can make like a moss milkshake. You take some moss, put it in a blender, whirl it up, and then just pour it over the rocks in your garden or whatever spot you want. And as long as there's enough moisture, they'll start to grow. There's no roots. And so mosses are very easy to propagate, and particularly in the right climate. Now, the hot, dry prairie, like July, August in the prairie, unless there's some shade, there's not much chance for moss to survive. But other than that, you know, you can grow it wherever you like. Yeah.
It seems like that might have been a feature, not a bug, because Alberta's got that. Because if you're in BC, it's wet all the time. You've got this moss around, but it's always wet. So maybe you figure out drying it out. Whereas in Alberta, you've got sometimes a year where you could just come across the same moss and it's already in that sort of dried out fashion. It's drying itself out for a couple months a year. It's almost like it's got its own cycle that benefits us.
Yeah. Yeah. Most common moss people know is sphagnum moss. And when you get into those areas, the moss actually exchange hydrogen ions right into the water and make it super, super acidic. And so that prevents anything else from growing there. And so sphagnum moss has created their own, you know, microclimate, so to speak. And then that's why they're so antiseptic. They are incredibly acidic, and they prevent the growth of gram-negative and positive bacteria. And in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that not only are some of the mosses adjuncts for chemotherapy, like I mentioned, for mushrooms. But some of the mosses contain compounds that actually increase the efficacy of antibiotics that are for drug-resistant bacteria. I don't know if you know this, but hundreds of thousands of people die in North America every year because they have a bacterium that has infected them that there's no longer a treatment for. Think about that. And one of the reasons is not that people are, it's true, some people are taking more antibiotics than they need. You don't need an antibiotic every time you get a flu. I mean, that's a viral thing. That's not bacterial. But 80% of the antibiotics that are produced in Canada are fed to animals, are fed to our cattle and our pigs and our chickens. This is ridiculous. And so this has created this antibiotic resistance in humans. Wow. So there are ways using mosses and ferns and lichens and mushrooms to help to overcome that drug resistance. So that's kind of exciting, I think.
That's super exciting. I have a sort of a dumb question or a strange question, but if you're living in the rainforest, like on BC coast or something, and you've got, you know, the moss starts gathering on all the roofs, and I think people think that's a bad thing, or it might seem like it's a bad thing. Is it a bad thing, or should you just leave the moss on the roofs? I mean, is the moss protecting your, like you said, with its own little microclimate, is it protecting your house from moss?
I mean, we're all talking about CO2 sequestering, like worrying about how much carbon dioxide is going into the atmosphere. Moss sequesters CO2 way more efficiently than your regular pristine Kentucky bluegrass lawn. I mean, people are obsessed with these tidy little lawns that they never use.
But what about the buildings themselves?
And in Japan, in parts of Washington State, and actually in one of my favorite places to go, and sometimes is out by Victoria, is the Bouchard Gardens. And they have a Japanese moss garden where they actually have 50 different types of moss cultivated there among, you know, water springs and whatever, just creating a peaceful environment. I mean, very, very common. I mean, the most famous moss garden is in Kyoto in Japan, or parts of Japan. And in that city alone, there are 1,700 temples that have moss gardens with them.
Wow.
Where people go just to relax. So
is it okay to leave it on your roof then? Is it okay to let it grow on your roof and leave it?
Yeah, why not? Sure.
Would it stop mold then?
It actually isn't going into the root. It's just lying there, right? It's not intruding into the tree itself, the root. It's just using it as a place to hang out. I mean, I've seen moss growing on iron railings, right? So they just hang out wherever they can find an environment that works.
And do they eat mold?
Do they eat mold? No, not that I know of. No. They do have. Now, having said that, that's an interesting question. The bryophytes, the liverworts, as we talked about earlier, they're a category in the bryophytes. They all contain essential oils. And these essential oils are very powerful against gram-negative and positive bacteria. Some are antiviral. Some are antifungal. So in a way, they've learned ways to protect themselves from other organisms. So when you say mold, which is a fungus, yes, some of the liverworts actually protect themselves from being eaten by another fungus.
Yeah. Okay.
We should get back to the book here a little bit before we run out of time. I got it here.
Oh, good.
And when I look through it, the thing that really jumps out is there's a ton of pictures, and it's almost like a field manual. It's something that even if you're not going to read it right now, but it's if you just have it on your shelf, maybe if you're a prepper and there's a collapse or whatever it is, but it's like you could just have this book with you with no previous knowledge and sort of find your way around your mosses, which makes me think it'd be interesting to just have one for the prairies in general.
I agree. Yeah. Well, you know, moss, I agree with you, and thank you for noting that. It's meant to be like a bit of an encyclopedia that is on your shelf. You find a moss, you walk along, you find, oh, I don't know what that is, identify it, and then you can read the chapter on it and then inform yourself about other uses of it and get kind of addicted that way. Sort of like once you start picking mushrooms, you get addicted to picking mushrooms, right? I warn people before they start. And before you know it, you're a moss addict and making use of them and learning more about them and perhaps sharing that with younger generations. I think we've really lost touch in a lot of ways with, it seems like young people today, they just want to play video games on look and stare at screens. And we have to really pay attention and help people understand that we are nature. It's not nature out there separate from us. We are nature. We're part of it. And we need to spend time in the woods. We need to spend time out there in the wild. I think it's super important. It's very important.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to spend like 60 days, just like I hunt a lot. So you really notice a difference between the winter when I'm working and I'm in my computer space and it's just work, compared to like how I feel coming into winter after spending 2 months on the plains hunting and fishing. And it's worth mentioning that moss is sort of a good, safe entry level because it doesn't seem like it has maybe the repercussions that mushrooms could have. Is that a correct statement?
You mean if you get the wrong one?
In terms of the wrong one, you mean eating the...
Yeah, exactly. Mushrooms always like, I don't fuck with mushrooms because it's like, if you're wrong, you can be really wrong. Is that a risk with moss? It seems like it's not.
Yeah, there's very few ingredients in any of the mosses that are going to be, you're never going to ingest enough of them to kill you for sure. And there are several mushrooms in Alberta that will do you serious harm and kill you. Yeah. So, but there's only about 8 of them. So once you learn those 8 mushrooms, you just learn to stay away from them.
That's the way to do it. That's the way to do it. Just really learn those 8.
Yep. Yeah, you do. And then everything else is either inedible, you know, some are just not edible. And then some are just are choice edibles. And the more, if you go out with somebody who's trained a bit, who knows a little bit about mushrooms, in the early days, I used to go out with my friend Martin Osis, who knows mushrooms. He's been part of the Alberta Mycological Society like for 40 years. And we would find mushrooms, and then sometimes we have to key them out to identify them. But basically, once you've learned 6 or 8 mushrooms a year with some experts, go out on forays, pretty soon you know 50 edible mushrooms, and that's satisfying for most people. That's the first thing people say, is it edible, right? Can I eat it? And many of them you can, and many of them you can dry for later on. The fairy rings that are in people's lawns, those are a choice edible. Choice, not the stipe, which is wiry and firm, but the caps themselves, you just put them on a newspaper, dry them, and then you add a couple of those to a super stew, and the Unami flavor is outstanding.
Wow,
just really delicious. Yeah.
And are they of more nutritional value? Because I mean, it's obvious that if I'm going to take my elk or my cow, the elk that's raised in the wild is going to be healthier. It doesn't have those antibiotics. It doesn't have just any of the stuff that even if it's organic, it's still going to find its way in. It's just not a organic's better, free range better, but I don't think it's ever going to be the same as an elk or a moose or something that is completely wild. It's sort of the same thing with fish, right? You got farmed salmon and then you have the other salmon, and it's starting to look like farm fish might be the worst thing on the planet for you. And so I'm wondering if mushrooms are the same. Like, can you grow a mushroom that'll ever be as good as the one that you could find in the wild?
Yes, you can. Yeah. People who do factory farming organically, those mushrooms are absolutely as good as anything that you find in the wild, and in some cases better, because mushrooms tend to be microaccumulators of heavy metals. And unless you know for sure that area is free of selenium or mercury or lead or whatever, you're better off getting something that was grown organically where you can actually see the content of lead. That's one of the reasons why things are changing. China used to produce over 90% of the mushrooms on the world for the world market. And that's really going on decline. And part of it is because even though, quote, they grow them organically certified in China, some of the product coming over is really high in heavy metals. You know, so, be sensible. Like you mentioned Paul Stamets earlier. Yeah, he produces mycelium products out of in Washington State. And we're now finding there's a big argument there's a big discussion out there about whether the fruiting body is better than the mycelium or vice versa or whatever. But you have to remember that the mycelium is the living body. You know, the only reason that fruiting bodies were the first thing to be talked about and discovered and researched is they're visible. You can see them. But we now have modern technology that allows us to grow on organic substrate all kinds of mushrooms, lion's mane and cordyceps and reishi and, you know, turkey tail and all of these on organic substrate that is free from heavy metals. And those are great products. And research is showing that, for example, lion's mane in the last few years has become incredibly popular.
Yep.
And they found that both the fruiting body and the mycelium both contain compounds that are brain neuron growth factors. And so both of them are useful, not just one or the other. They're both useful. Yeah.
Before we start to wrap up, Robert, is there anything that we missed? Anything we should have asked you that we didn't?
You did a pretty good job. I hope you can edit out some of that stuff at the beginning. I assume you have an editing machine or something. Yeah.
We usually keep it pretty casual and we don't edit a lot. So,
okay. Well, fair enough. You know, but you know, I would say, no, you did a good job. I can't really think of anything that I'd like to add. I would say that people who are interested in the subject, you might find pick up a Moss Medicine book and you can also, for those who are more in the wild, like you are quite a bit of the time, you can also get an ebook of it as well. And you can put that on your phone and then you can right there on the spot rather than carrying a heavy book with you in the bush. Yeah.
Robert Rogers, this has been...
You don't have an app for that yet? Is there going to be an app for that, do you think, at some point?
I don't really trust the apps. I really don't. No, the mushroom apps, the plant apps are highly, highly ineffective by and large.
Really?
I wouldn't say that totally, but I wouldn't trust myself, actually. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
You wouldn't need a mushroom that you scanned with the app. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I would say, you know, I wouldn't bet my life on a identification of a mushroom on an app at this point. I'd rather know for myself. Somebody taught me and I know and I pass on. Yeah. And like I said, there's only about 8 in the prairies. So, you know, no problem.
I was going to ask you just before we wrap it up. 8 on the prairies. Is there quite a few more on the coast? Does that expect
only a couple more?
Okay.
Yeah, there's not that many, maybe a dozen. When I teach classes on Vancouver Island, and there's some of those that you have to be careful. And one of the things that's interesting is you can get the same genus of mushroom, and this one it'll have a certain, say, gray spores, yellow looking, and it's edible. And then there's another one that's the same genus, different species, and will make you incredibly sick.
Wow.
You might not die, but you wish you were dying, right? and so you learn, go slow. Mushrooms are, I would say, 10 times harder to identify than plants. Because I started out as an herbalist. And and even that can be difficult till you start to learn the patterns.
Yeah.
But mushrooms are way more difficult. And mosses are even more difficult.
What about overall on mushrooms before we wrap up? Is there like, or is it like 50-50, or is there just way more mushrooms that are not going to kill you than are going to kill you? Is it sort of overhyped?
There are very few mushrooms that will kill you. And every year we do hear, particularly the one that really is getting a lot of controversy lately is one actually that was in California, a family of about eight people ate the Amanita, the death cap. And when it comes up early, it looks like a little button mushroom, but it's got a vulva, and then later on it grows up at pure white. And people, I think they were of Vietnamese descent, who were used to picking a certain mushroom where they lived there. They mistook them, and most of them died. One of them lived with a liver transplant, but it's an excruciatingly bad way to go. Right? You know, you eat the mushroom, you feel ill, you throw up, you go, oh, no, I escaped that. And then 3 to 4 days later, you die of kidney and liver failure.
Wow.
So yes, there are a few, but there's only a few of them. Like I say, it's easier to learn the ones you shouldn't pick than it is all the ones that you could.
Yeah.
Robert Rogers, this has been great. We encourage everyone to pick up the book, Moss Wisdom. Like I say, it's an encyclopedia. It's not one of those ones you're going to read cover to cover right away, but you keep it in your car or in your truck, or get the ebook, like you mentioned, and you can identify these things in real time in the field. I like that it's not just like a shitty drawing or a black and white picture. It's a nice full color picture so you could really identify it. I'll probably get your mushroom one just so I have that one as well. So where can people get the books? Do you have a website? Do you have social media? We'll put all your URLs in the show notes, of course, but we find only about half the people get to the show notes. So we like to mention them in the audio as well.
Well, I thank you for that. Fortunately, you guys are in Canada, which is really a pleasant change. Almost all, mostly I get interviewed by American podcasters, and I can't refer them to our website because we can't ship across the border easily. So in Canada, you go to our website. It's called www.selfhealdistributing.com. And you'll see my 65 books will be there. My wife's also an author. She's got a number of titles that interest you. But we also have their flower essences, mushroom essences, essential oils. So there's a plethora of things that people can check out if they go to the site. And also on there, when I do courses in the summer, I'll often listen. What you can go over to one of the downloads is courses. And I'll list where I'm doing walks this summer. I'm going to do a few. Yeah.
Excellent. Robert Rogers, the book, Moss Medicine. We encourage everyone to pick it up. Thank you for coming on the show. Fellow Albertan, always nice to have another freedom-loving Albertan on the show who knows what it's all about. We appreciate you. Appreciate your work. Come back anytime.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Well, maybe when the cacti book is out, remember, we'll have to talk about cacti.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Robert. Okay. Nice to meet you.
Take care. Bye-bye now. Thank you.
And that was our chat with Robert Rogers, Moss Medicine, Robert Dale Rogers. Indigenous wisdom and modern pharmacology. Like we say, we encourage everyone to check it out. It's a really cool book. You'll have to check this one out when you come. I think I'll get the mushroom one instead. You know, because I had bought a while ago, because I'm out hunting so much, I had bought this prairie one for my, that has supposed to have all the medicinal and plants you can eat in the prairies, just to have, because you spend a lot of time in the blind or sitting around or this and that. But it was all like sketches of it. And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck this is. But the picture makes it just so much easier to really comprehend what's going on there than those little sketches. So I ended up just not using it. But big thanks to
Big thanks to Robert for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you are one of the few who do choose to support the work over at grimerica.ca/support. We keep doing the show for free. We'll keep doing it for free up to 752 episodes. This will be, I think, all for free. No ads, no back catalogs, no paywalls. Just head over to grimerica.ca/support today. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation and support our value for value model, which will keep the podcast going. Other than that, check out grimericaoutlaw.ca for our other podcast. Contact at thecabin.com for trips and events, and adultbrain.ca for all of those audiobooks. Guess I could start pumping disastermap.ca too on this one if people want to check that out. Other than that, love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
So many.